tonight on Arena. Toby Jones on his role as Mr. Burton and Mr. Bates in Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And live guitar music from Plenio Fernandez. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. From Truman Capote to Alfred Hitchcock to Dobby the House Elf, the BAFTA and Olivier Award-winning actor Toby Jones has built an impressive career on stage, TV and film. But it was his work last year on Mr. Bates versus the Post Office that elevated him to national treasure status in his native Britain. Such was the unprecedented impact of the drama series, which was watched by 14 million people in the UK. Toby Jones can be seen in cinemas now in Mr. Burton, a biographical film which tells the story of how one Richard Jenkins from Port Talbot in Wales became Richard Burton, star of stage and screen. In the film, Toby Jones plays Philip Burton, who was teacher, mentor and eventually legal guardian of the young actor. Sinead Egan spoke to Toby Jones earlier today about Mr. Burton. But before we hear that conversation, let's listen to a clip from the film. In this scene, Mr. Burton has taken young Jenkins up to the hills above Port Talbot to teach him about vocal projection.
Let's hear it.
All for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
Stop! That is mostly dreadful. Right. Stand firm, plant your feet, shoulders back, head erect. Good. Let's give it another try. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. Are you able to hear that?
Yes.
Good. Now you have a try.
Offer a muse of fire. They would ascend.
Stop! Was I shouting?
No.
Volume, Jenkins, is of secondary importance. Distinctness. This is what you must learn.
Now. Toby Jones, welcome to Arena. Toby, how did you come to this story? How aware were you that there was this crucially important figure in the background of Richard Burton's life?
About 6 years ago, Mark Evans, the director, approached me about this script, which I read, and it was all entirely new to me. I knew of Richard Burton. I didn't know of Richard Jenkins, as it were, and I certainly didn't know of Philip Burton.
And I mean, you've played real life figures before. You've played superstars like Truman Capote. You've played Alfred Hitchcock. And more recently, you've played Alan Bates. And like Alan Bates, Philip Burton, he wasn't a famous person. He wasn't well known, but he had this huge impact on people's lives. How do you approach that kind of role where you're playing a real person, but I suppose his characteristics aren't as known?
No, I mean, with Alan Bates, that was fairly straightforward because I could talk to Alan, resistant as he was to the whole project, I think, at the beginning. But the whole idea of someone playing him, he wasn't entirely kind of convinced that it was possible because he felt so unremarkable. But in terms of Philip, there were various autobiographies and indeed some YouTube footage. But in general, the first point is that the dramatist has usually done the crucial work of selecting which elements of a character you're going to play. And I suppose what one's doing with the rest of the research is trying to fuel, give yourself information about the minute little decisions that no one knows about that you're going to have to make on the day. Like, how does he pick up his fork? How does he open a door? How does he get into bed? You know, all of that stuff where I've always found it incredibly useful to get those sort of everyday actions in showing character and emotion. And that those are effectively invention.
I was going to say, because, I mean, there was nobody you could really talk to about what he was like as a person, was there?
No. Kate Burton, Richard's daughter, referred to him as her grandfather, but you know, she would have been very young when she knew him, and they did know each other. But in a way, yeah, I had enough information to what I needed from books and stuff.
How would you characterize their relationship, Toby?
It's a classic inspirational teacher relationship. What makes it remarkable, I think, are the unlikelihood of the situation. These days, one doesn't, it's almost like you don't, there is less social mobility now in a weird way. Oddly, you know, a boy getting to grammar school and finding an inspirational teacher, one wonders now whether, just because of the financial constraints that kids are under, whether they feel that they have the money to be able to risk that kind of lifestyle. That said, yeah, Philip, I think, detected in Richard a romanticism, a love of language, and an enthusiasm, which was quite remarkable. And I think that Richard saw in Philip a way out of his situation.
The power of education, just as you were saying, the power of education and mentorship really resonates through the film. Yeah. Did you have somebody like this in your life?
I think I had several people. I count myself hugely fortunate that I think I've had several people. I was asked about this the other day, and I said, in a weird way, my father, who certainly wasn't my teacher, but he loved poetry in a way that he was purely enthusiastic about language and poetry, knew huge reams of poetry in his memory, and would declaim this stuff because he was an actor and had immediate access to it. And in a way, he taught me to not fear language. But then at school, I suppose I learned language in a different way, through having to pass exams, but also being pretty enthusiastic about speaking out, reading in class and things. And then in drama, I had lots of opportunities to do drama at school, but I went to a drama school in Paris, where the teacher changed my life and continues to change my life, even though he's dead. I mean, what I learned there, I continue to use every day of my life, really.
You mentioned your father, Freddie, and he was an actor too. And our listeners might remember him from The Elephant Man, and he was Sandy for many years on Emmerdale. And he was of a similar vintage to Richard Burton. Did you find parallels in their early stories?
Very, very much so. That was one of the other things that I found very moving about the story, is that my father was brought up in the Potteries in Staffordshire in a very tough very tough industrial landscape when he was growing up in the 30s. And the idea of becoming an actor was like going to another galaxy. It just wasn't an option, in a way that you feel the same for Richard Jenkins. And for my dad, he entered the world of work after drama school and became sort of lab assistant. I don't really know what his job was, but he was totally alienated from the work environment. And he would write poetry and he would go to classical concerts. And had this, as I say, enthusiasm for language, but it didn't seem to lead anywhere. And then when he was about 29, very late on, a girlfriend suggested to him that he probably wasn't a poet, but that she sensed that he had this huge romantic spirit, and she suspected he was an actor, and she actually applied to drama school on his behalf.
Wow. That's a lovely story.
Yeah.
Accent and voice are really so important in this film. And Harry Lawty as Richard Burton, at the start, he has this beautiful musical Welsh accent, which gradually deepens into that famous baritone, which was Richard Burton's calling card. What was it that Philip did with Richard to get that famous voice, do you think? And how important was the voice? Was that the goal, do you think, for him, or one of the many goals?
I wonder nowadays how important voice training is. But I think, from going back to my father, he literally had to lose his Potteries accent, his Staffordshire accent. And he never really spoke in it again unless you asked him to. And I think what happened with Richard was, you know, Philip, you had to, at that period, lose your dialect. I mean, the whole idea of calling it a dialect now, as if RP is proper speaking,
yeah,
we would see as kind of politically objectionable thing to say. But in those days, there was a proper way of speaking, and the actors had to do that. And Philip basically introduced him to that way of speaking. And nowadays, you have people phoning into programs like yours, complaining they can't hear actors, and they and I suppose or can't understand what they're saying. And I suppose what happens is you get different fashions in terms of what is considered truthful, what is considered realistic and naturalistic, and that is a, and those are styles of acting. And in a weird way, we're denied knowing the impact Richard had, because I think his style would seem to us to be quite stagey now.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was actually reintroducing, as you see in the film, he's trying to introduce a level of psychological truth to the part of Hal in Henry the Fourth. You actually see that transition, even though the way he's doing it and the production he's in look to us to be incredibly dated. So there is that sense that, you know, what is considered authentic and realist isn't stable in any form of art, you know, whether it's acting, painting, whatever it is. It's constantly shifting. And so, but Richard had a remarkable voice. I mean, it was a voice, regardless of what style of acting he had, it was a remarkably resonant voice and immediately identifiable. You know, I first heard it on that War of the Worlds album in the 1970s, and it was just this fearful kind of gravity that it had, this huge sort of power. And I can't think of another actor with a more powerful voice than Richard Burton.
Port Talbot as a town, which I believe you filmed there, you know, it's really punching above its weight when it comes to successful actors, you'd have to say. Obviously, there's Richard Burton, but then Anthony Hopkins, Michael Sheen and Rob Brydon.
Yeah.
Do you think it was Burton himself who was the inspiration to all the others, or is there something in the water there?
I suspect there's something in the water, because I actually asked Anthony Hopkins about whether he'd ever met Burton. And he had met Burton in an art class. He told me he was doing an art class, and his art teacher, it transpired, was going out with Richard Burton. But he was a child, you know, Hopkins. But as I sort of mentioned earlier, I think that role models, you know, when you feel so far away from, I suppose, London, and which is for the English and the Welsh, for the British is the hub of the sort of mecca of theatre, I suppose you need role models to show you that it's possible. And clearly Burton was a trailblazer. Both Philip Burton and Richard Jenkins were trailblazers in that regard, because they show that there is a route there. They show that it's not unfeasible. So I suppose there is a link. Michael, who I've worked with a couple of times, I think his father was a looky-likey, and I think by the time you get to the 80s and 90s, when we were training, Michael and I don't think being an actor was as outlandish a proposition as it was for people growing up in the 40s and 50s, for working class people.
And what was it like filming in Port Talbot?
I'd always driven through Port Talbot on that motorway heading towards Pembrokeshire, and you pass this huge industrial site, and clearly the steelworks is closing now, and there was a lot of that in the air of anxiety. You could feel it in the fabric of the town, and people, it was the first thing on people's lips. Nonetheless, the sun shone, and the mountains rising above Port Talbot, and even the glory of those steelworks, the drama of those steelworks, I absolutely loved it. I mean, quite apart from the glorious people there, going to these little towns and villages, you can't believe how they exist. You can't now, because of the coal disappearing and the steel disappearing. But the people are so warm and welcoming, and we were very lucky with the sunshine, as you see in the film. And in a way, Mark Evans, who is Welsh, obviously, he delights in that landscape. And the landscape is a feature of the film.
and it really comes across. Toby, before I let you go, people are comparing the Netflix series Adolescence to ITV's Mr. Bates and The Post Office, obviously, which you starred in yourself. Both have had big impacts on society. Both were discussed in the House of Commons. What was it like to be, what is it like to be involved in a drama that really can precipitate change?
Well, I feel very proud of the fact that I've done it. And I'm aware that a lot of actors who've been lovely about the show and have drawn strength from it. Because it's certainly not the first show that has had that aim and ambition to do that. But it's rare that they deliver in such a material way. The fact that, you know, things were spoken in Parliament 3 days after transmission and broadcast. So I feel very, very proud of that. At the same time, I don't think I'll ever, I don't think I will feel full satisfaction until, you know, they get justice and they get what they deserve. And the people who've died, you know, we don't want to see any more people dying before they receive justice, because at the moment it's such a protracted process. It's quite hard to feel full satisfaction because it's so frustrating.
Toby Jones, thank you for talking to Arena this evening and congratulations on the film.
Cheers, thank you.
And that was actor Toby Jones speaking to Sinead Egan. His film Mr. Burton is in selected cinemas now. Born and raised in Sao Paulo, Plinio Fernandes mixes classical guitar with Brazilian folk music. Since releasing his debut album, Saudad, in 2022, he has gone on to work with artists such as Lang Lang and Sheku Kane Mason, playing some of the most prestigious venues on the international circuits, like Radio City Music Hall in New York, and last August he made his BBC Proms debut. Plinio is about to start on tour in Ireland as part of Music Network's Spring programme. I'm delighted that Plinio Fernandes is with me now in studio and going to play live for us in a moment. You're very welcome back to Ireland. You did a concert tour before. You just did one date in Ireland, is that right?
That's correct. Well, thanks for having me here. It's wonderful being back. I played one concert and gave a masterclass at the Royal Irish Conservatoire in 2023. And that I played a duo recital with my friend Sheku Kane Mason.
All right. And he's a cellist.
He's a cellist, exactly.
You're rightly described as a virtuoso guitar player. But your influences are Brazilian music, folk music, but also classical music.
Yes. Essentially, I'm a classical guitarist from scratch, because most of my friends start playing either any of the Brazilian genres or rock, and then they move into classical guitar. Yeah, I was the other way around, really. But yes, classical guitar, the repertoire is the core of what I do. And of course, being Brazilian and having such a rich variety of guitar tradition and music all together is, yeah, it's natural to combine both.
Yes, and it's not only the Brazilian tradition you're interested in. There's the whole of South America. And the first song you're going to play is of Chilean heritage. That's... Tell us a little about it before you go and play.
Of course. So this song, arranged for guitar by my friend Emmanuel Sovich, is called Graças a la Vida, and is one of the anthems of Latin America. It was composed by Violeta Parra, but I think it's widely more well known with Mercedes Sosa singing that. And it's called Thanks to Life, which is, you know, a tribute to life. And the lyrics are one of the most beautiful lyrics I've ever encountered. And it's really one of those songs that you, if you play or sing anywhere in South America, everyone could recognize and feel that this belongs to them, even though it's specifically from Chile. Is that there's that communal feeling about that.
Well, you're going to play Gracias a la Vida now for us. Thank you. So that's Plinio Fernandez playing Gracias a la Vida there. And that was beautiful. You really get that. I think you say yourself that you don't need the words when you're playing songs like that on the guitar, because the guitar almost speaks the words for you.
Well, we have the words, of course, are much more straightforward in a way. You hear them and that causes an emotion with you. But we have different tools on the guitar and the different colors and different ways of pronouncing that. So we have to dig in into the text and the feeling of the words without them to translate that into music expression.
Now, I was talking about your debut album, which was So Dad, and that's when you were living in London, I think you, well, you're still living in London, but you've been living in London for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And it means nostalgia. Was that the inspiration of it, that living abroad and thinking of Brazil and thinking of all the people you weren't with at the time?
Absolutely. That being my debut album for Universal Music, I had to make a mark with something that was really natural for me, and that actually, yeah, was a statement about the artist who I am. And of course, being in London now for 11 years, back then like 8, and being away from home for such a long time, and being Brazilian, there's a very specific thing of the connection with, you know, any other nationality, but especially with culture and art and music. And so I just made a compilation of the things that moved me the most throughout that journey.
And now, you are very interested in classical music, and the Brazilian tradition of classical music is so strong. And you have done a whole album, which is a nod to Bach and also to Villa-Loba, who is the great Brazilian classical music. Can you explain the connection between those two great composers?
Of course. They happen to be my two favorite composers, and Bach actually was the main inspiration in Villa-Lobos' output in every single way. He even wrote a series of pieces called the Bachianas, which are homages to Bach. Of course, as you mentioned, Villa-Lobos is the most important figure in Brazilian culture altogether, but in classical music specifically. And everything that came after him was inspired by that. And of course, him being not an ambassador, but having such a strong influence of Bach, gave room for all the other composers who came afterwards to do the same and to actually create little pieces in Baroque style and or have the melodic lines or a lot of that influence translated into Brazilian music. I tried to show that connection.
All right. And do you think there's something very compatible between that Brazilian sensibility and Bach?
Absolutely, absolutely. People think about Brazilian music about being very outwards and very vibrant rhythmically and so on and so forth, but there are many different sides to Brazilian music, and this is one of them. Immaculate sense of melody, that goes through, you know, all the bossa nova and folk singing that happens in Brazil.
Now, you have done your own album of Bach music, and now you're going to play for us Prelude number 3. This is from Villa-Lobos, so mm-hmm. We're connecting, obviously, your love of Bach with the great Brazilian composer. Tell us a little bit about it before you play it.
Yeah, of course. So each of the preludes, he wrote a set of 5. Each of them is a homage to a different facet of Brazilian culture. But this Prelude number 3 is a homage to Bach, and it's quite, well, you hear the influences in there. But that's it. I think this is the embodiment of that that connection.
Well, I'll let you take your place to play. This is Prelude number 3.
Thank you.
That's Prelude number 3, composed by Hector Villa-Lobos, performed there by Plinio Fernandez. And Plinio Fernandez is at the Station House Theatre, Clifton, tomorrow night, at Glorian Ennis on the 9th of April, the National Opera House, Wexford, on the 9th of April, and the Medieval Museum in Waterford on the 10th of April, and finishing at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary on the 13th of April. You're going to be busy. All details from musicnetwork.ie. Plinio, so nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Bealtaine Festival is Ireland's annual celebration of arts and expression as we age, with events all over the country throughout the month of May. This year, the festival is 30 years on the go, with a programme that includes the panel discussion, The Lives of Artists, at Project Arts Centre in Dublin on the 2nd of May. The artists in question are Pom Boyd, actor and writer, Philippa Donlan, dancer and choreographer, musician and theatre maker Sean Miller, and visual artist Alan O'Kelly and poet Enda Wiley. They'll be talking about sustaining creative lives over the long haul. I'm delighted that Alan O'Kelly and Enda Wiley are with me in studio, and Pom Boyd is on the line from New York. Pom, you're very welcome, as is Alana and Enda.
Thanks, Kay.
So you're in New York because you're there with a show, In Two Minds. Well, tell us a little bit about that, and how is it going down in New York?
So this is a fish amble show, and it's written by Joanne Ryan, and it's a story about her mother who had bipolar disorder. So it's a mother-daughter story, and it's myself and Karen McCartney. I play the mother, I play Joanne's mother. It's based on her mother. It's become another character now. And yeah, we're doing it in 59 East 59, which is a theatre in Midtown Manhattan, and it's going really well. The New York audiences are loving it.
Isn't that fantastic?
And
Our listeners will know you also from the hit TV series The Dry. But just for this Bealtaine event, I want to bring you back a little bit to how you started off. What was it like starting off in your creative life? I suppose it was acting was the first thing you wanted to do, Pom.
Well, it was. Well, you know, I always say I never consciously chose acting. I it was very much part of the fabric of my upbringing. My mother had been an actress, and, you know, I grew up as a sort of free range childhood, where dressing up and living in my own little world was very, very much, you know, my thing. And then, you know, I didn't do terribly well at school. I sort of opted out of school, so I didn't have any formal qualification, even though I had been a good student. But I had always acted in the school plays, and I had been given the leading roles without ever really looking for them. I think the teachers probably thought it was good for me to do it or whatever. Anyway, so I sort of wandered out into the world knowing that I could do this thing. And I think I was looking for a life that could give me exciting escapades and a lot of time to myself to retreat, which is kind of how I like to live my life. I go out and have an adventure and then come home and have a lot of time to think and, you know.
And I think you found fellow-minded artists in the Grapevine Arts Centre in North Great George's Street.
Yeah, the Grapevine was amazing. The Grapevine, because there were no paths to get in. If you wanted to be an actor, there wasn't the Lear, there wasn't the Gaiety School of Acting, there wasn't any acting school. The only thing that existed was the Abbey actors, you know, the players there, the Abbey Theatre Company, and that seemed like an impossible. And also, I didn't really have that much interest in mainstream theatre. So the Grapevine was this incredible hub of artists and creative and political activity as well, actually. So, you know, you could do theatre workshops or Tai Chi or get a haircut or just hang out, you know, with other artists. So it was a great place. And I did theatre workshops there. Tom McGinty was running theatre workshops, but I did them somewhere else. And then I joined, they formed a little theatre company, and off we went in the yellow Volkswagen van, touring touring the country.
So as you know, I'm here with Enda Wiley and Alana O'Kelly.
Yes.
And they're listening into what you're saying, Pom. Enda, as a poet, again, how did you get your start? Did you just start writing poetry naturally?
I was born just writing it. Okay. No, just to say hello to Pom there. And I loved, Pom, when you were speaking about that of adventure. It's lovely to hear you speak in New York. We're all very jealous. But yeah, I began, when I was very young, actually. I was about coming in, actually, I was thinking about what happened to me was a bit odd. I wrote a poem when I was about 9 and I threw it away. I thought it was useless. And my mum, because you always need someone to say yes to you, she ironed it and she sent it off, I didn't know, to a competition in Donerail, and I won it. And then I suddenly had to go down with all my family and met John A. Murphy, this big professor. I thought she was ancient. And he gave me the collected works of Canon Sheehan as a prize. So if that didn't turn me off writing poetry, I don't know what would.
Oh, poor Canon Sheehan. Anyway, he's turning and he's great.
So I kind of just kept going from there, really. And I was lucky in my school. My teachers encouraged me. And actually, I met Evan Boland here in RT because, again, it was another competition. My teacher sent a poem in and Evan chose it. And she was actually the first poet that I really met. And I had to sit beside her in studio. And I remember being so nervous. I was about 15 and I had to read my poem about Martin Luther King. But you see, I think because I began so young, there were a lot of great poets around and they were always up for encouraging younger poets as well, which was really brilliant. So it was quite a vibrant scene, you know.
And then, of course, you were also helped by the great David Marcus, who gave so many writers their first chance.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, it was probably your third or fourth chance.
Well,
given
I think
how
at that
well
stage, I was kind of just probably at the back of English class feeling a bit bored or something. And I just for fun, because it was all about fun and energy and having a great time. That's why I love being part of this Bealtaine Festival, because the theme is lust for life. And I think that's what I had as a teenager, and I just loved writing. So I just fired off some poems to David Marcus. I thought I was really being a bit of a chancer, but he really kindly wrote back to me. He was a very good editor. He started off loads of writers, and there was a bit of a thrill because he published my poems alongside Paul Durkin. So it was all great, you know. And I think that, you know, like we're talking about tonight, like creativity and aging and going forward and how do you sustain art and all that stuff. But I think when you're young, it's really great to lay foundations where it'll keep you going, you know. And to meet someone like Evan Boland at an early age, it kind of showed me that, yeah, you can keep going and you can keep writing. And it's exciting. And as Pom says, it is an adventure.
Alana, as a visual artist who is such a wonderful conceptual artist now working in all different kinds of media, where did you start out? Did you start out like drawing or painting?
Well, it's really interesting hearing Enda and hearing Pom talking, because I was really hopeless at art in school. I always blamed the teaching, really. I don't think it was very good. And in general, the teaching of art in schools hasn't been very good, actually. But that's another story. But I think I flashed on something lovely that happened at home. I think a lot of my creativity came through my home and through my parents. They traveled a lot and they allowed a lot of space for us as kids, and we played a lot in very vigorous ways, and played with materials a lot, and didn't worry about dirt, and you know, so we got kind of stuck in different ways, no matter what the material. And so there was this lovely sense of materiality and space and colour and light and fun and all of those things that are actually the groundwork for creativity in so many ways. So
I think Art College was a huge eye-opener for you.
Art College really was. I was lucky enough to have some of the people like Nigel Rolfe and people like that come. And he brought a lot of performance artists that scared me silly at the time. I remember some of these young people and looking at the work that they do and being really kind of frightened by it. But then some of that work I still think about. It moved me and it shifted me and it frightened me and it asked questions. And, you know, the energy was really bright and kind of scary and wonderful. There was a big world out there that needed to be explored. And I think that's how I got into sculpture in that way, and conceptual work, but you know, using very you know.
Yes, I was looking back on your wonderful body of work, and then the, you know, Pam there was talking about the politics of the time when she was there in the great Fine Arts Centre, and you went to Greenham Common, which was like such a protest that time. There was a nuclear a weapons station there, and a whole group of women set up a camp there, and you did an art piece based on that.
Well, I did. Yeah, that was interesting though, because I just went to protest and I wasn't thinking about a piece of artwork, but I saw these group of women. It was a women's protest and it was a women's camp, as you know, in Greenham Common. And I saw these group of women sitting around at one stage. It was during a protest called Sounds Around the Base. And they were all making these sounds and I was looking at them and I was thinking, God, what are, that's like keening. That's like they're keening. That's what they're actually doing, even though I'd never heard keening. And but I could feel it. I could feel the energy from their group. And that's really how that piece came about. I came back to my studio and started the need to use my voice physically and literally.
Which is back again now.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because it's fantastic. It's been bought by Imma, and since then it's been kind of shown, and now people in England want it. And yeah, so it's great to have it. But it's a very old piece of work, but it's great to see that it's out there and it kind of has lasted in a way, you know.
Pam, you said there that you knew you could do the acting bit, but when did you realise then you could actually make works, you know, make theatre that you could be part of or cast other people in?
Well, it did kind of go hand in hand, because it was always on a needs must basis, you know, that I knew that I had to create my own work in order to get work. As I've already said, you know, it was difficult to get in anywhere. So it was making work from the start. Like the Grapevine, that's what it was. It was improvisation. It was writing sketches. It was all writing, and then creating characters, which I would perform at late night gigs and stuff. So the characters, I always knew I could communicate with people, make them laugh, and the writing was kind of just a means to an end. And then I never thought I could write a play. I never particularly wanted to write a play, but Siobhan Burke in Rough Magic gave me my first commission, and I'm eternally grateful to her for that. And that was a big stepping stone. I'd already written a one-woman show, and you know, but it wasn't a sort of a three-act structure, so I didn't even know that I could do that. You know, I thought plays were only written by men in big coats.
Yes, tell us a little about that play, because that was it was such an important play at the time.
It was, yeah, it was. And funny enough, it was never really fully the play I wanted to write. So, but it was, you know, Rough Magic did a great production of it, and it had a lovely cast, Peter Caffrey, rest in peace, and Deirdre Donnelly, and some lovely actors in it, so that was quite significant to write that type of play. But then I haven't really written a sort of a three act play since. I've always been sort of drawn to making sort of more, I don't know, work outside the box, really. So the next sort of piece of theatre that I would see would be quite seminal in my career is the show Shame that I did in 2018, which was a departure because it was personal, you know, and I realised actually that's what the kind of work I wanted to make. And it had music, live music. It was kind of gig theatre type of show with video, and which video is now so much part of theatre. Excuse me, but yeah.
How many collections have you now? Six collections of poetry.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So are you, do you feel you're mid-career? If somebody was to ask you, you know, as an artist, where do you see yourself? Do you look back on collections? Or are you forever charging ahead?
No, I always think that it's my first collection all over again. I have a new book coming out hopefully in the autumn of this year, but you're always like fingers crossed. You hope that you can fill the page, that the poems will keep coming. You just you just want to keep going forward, you know. There's a poem in the book that I'm writing called Charging, and I feel like that. You know, the day charges, you wake up and you just go for it. And one of my favourite poets, Miroslav Volop, says, open the door, at least there'll be a draft, you know. So he's got this poem about opening the door, go outside. And that's what I do a lot. I mean, I go out, actually, you know, I'm probably... I do actually sit at my desk, but I do go out as well. And I think that's where I get my most of my energy and my inspiration from, being out there in the world and overhearing, listening to people, you know, eavesdropping and seeing things. That's how I get
my
inspiration.
So you're not stuck to the poem and, you know, scribbling and, crossing out.
You know, I do think you have to scribble. I've got my notebook with me, or I come home and I get an idea and then it'll just come. And then it's, for me, it's the buzz of something appearing on the page. And it's great listening to Alana and Pom there talking about their journey, you know. But it's a strange thing. It comes when you least expect it, really, a poem. You know, you could be sitting at your desk all morning and, as I say, go out the door and then something happens and then it comes. I mean, Emily Dickinson said it was as if your head is being chopped off, you know, when you can just feel it. It's that rush, it's that enthusiasm. And like, I hope I never lose it. I mean, that's what we want. We want to keep going, don't we, Alana? And keep producing. Yeah. And Pom.
Yeah, Pom.
I just think that's so interesting what you're saying, and about that spark of creativity, because you really recognize it when it happens and you really recognize it when it doesn't happen as well. Yeah. But you know, and they talk about the inside out and outside in, and you know, some actors work from the outside in, some work from the inside out. But often for me, especially back in the day when I was creating characters, it would be wandering into a thrift store or a secondhand shop and seeing an item of clothing, and that would inspire the character. And before you knew it, that would, you know, from that one piece of clothing, you'd have who the character was, and then that would go into what they say and what they talk about. So it all came, yeah. You know, that's that small spark. And I think that spark can be anything.
Yeah. Mm. In the same way, there's such materiality in your work, Alana. Mm. What triggers inspiration for you?
Everything, everyday life, as Enda and Pom are saying, you know, a walk, people around me, animals, sounds, everything, you know, is triggering. I think for me, sometimes some of the problems is editing, and, you know, I must have thousands of sounds and trying to edit and make sense of what the next piece of work is about. I nearly always have too much, and then there's all this pulling stuff out and peeling it back and getting it a little more, you know, layering it a little. And
are the three of you people who write a lot and then pair back, or is there any other way of doing it? I don't mean write in your case.
Yeah, no,
Alana.
I understand you. I feel like sometimes I have a big pool in front of me, and it could be 5 or 6 pieces of work, or I could bring them together and maybe there's links there and maybe they make sense. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I've done that in the past, and then sometimes I've let a piece go out on its own, and then years later I've pulled it back into it. I drive some people mad, because I just, you know, some people often ask me, when did you make that piece of work? And I realise, well, I did make it, you know, in the 80s, but actually I brought some sound in 2005, and then I made it in, you know. So I'm always pulling pieces over and back, you know. It's not a linear journey.
I mean, it is an act of discovery, really, isn't it? You're never sure where you're going. Yeah. And if you did, I think then there would be a problem. I like just wandering and seeing what's going to happen. And I do edit a lot, and I've had to do it for the past few weeks. But I like, first and foremost, just to go with the energy and let the poem come out on the page and not worry about punctuation or form or line or anything like that, and just get it out and then play with it. Because it is play, I think. And I think Pom was saying that earlier, you as well, Alana. And it is funny, actually, when you write a poem, or when you make a piece of art, or you're in a play, or you write a play, you can, I'm sure, think you can... for years to come, remember the exact place you were in when it came to you, the smell, the light, the sound of the room, what triggered it. And as I said earlier, it can be unexpected, you know.
Is it easier now, Pom, to make work? You know, there seems to be more money available from the Arts Council anyway.
Oh, God, not for theatre.
No, I just wonder, really.
I think theatre's really struggling. You know, it's getting harder and harder to get funding, and, you know, just being an actor, I think, is getting harder, because you know, everything comes back to housing. So if you don't have a stable living environment, it's very hard to go out from that, you know. So I think that is really affecting it for theatre makers. And it is, Enda, you might disagree, and Alana, you might disagree as well, but, you know, theatre is minimum wage, basically, you know, like, so the fact that there's film and TV work, I think a lot of younger actors are going to migrate over to that because it's so hard to survive as an actor, you know.
Briefly,
I do think that it is very hard for artists. It's very hard to make a living. I agree with you, Pam. I mean, for most of my life, I was a teacher as well. So, you know, that's why I supplemented my writing. But now I'm full time, but that is what I did. But that inspired me as well. So I think if you have other work, it can help as well. But
And getting commissions, you know, like the commission from Bealtaine was when I got that Southeast commission. That was amazing. That kept me going for a long time, and it fed work, you know, forward
absolutely.
And backwards. It's those sometimes, you know, in the Arts Council commissions, all those are so meaningful. Yeah. You know,
they're so meaningful. And during COVID, because I was doing my Windy Lady, the Windy Lady is a character that I do, and Bealtaine had commissioned a show. I was going to tour the show, and then COVID hit. But what we did instead was we put her online, you know, and I made the videos at home.
Well, Pam, I'm going to have to
draw
an end to our discussion. But the lucky thing is that people can join the panel discussion, The Lives of Artists, with Pam Boyd, Alana O'Kelly and Enda Wiley and those other artists I mentioned earlier at 2:30 on Friday, the 2nd of May. And that's at Project Arts Centre. The Bealtaine Festival takes place nationwide throughout the month of May. Further details from bealtaine.ie. Thank you very much for taking part. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Mark McGraw was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. Sean Rocks is back tomorrow. John Creedon is next after the news.